Welcome, friend. This is James Corbett. You're tuned into CorbettReport.com on the 18th of March, 2013. And today we are joined on the line from my home and native land of Canada by Dr. Tim Ball, a previous guest on this podcast. And we've talked to him many times in the past, so you can check my website for our archives for our previous conversations. But perhaps more fittingly, you can check his own website. That's drtimball.com, drtimball.com. And of course, that will be linked up in the show notes for today's interview. So once again, Dr. Tim Ball, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, James.
Well, it is an exciting conversation that we can have today because we have a very interesting development to discuss. And this relates actually to an article that you wrote very recently that was posted on your website, as well as one of the largest science-related websites in the world, whatsupwiththat.com, back at the end of last month. And that was an article entitled, "It's Time for the Person Who Leaked the CRU Emails to Step Forward." And that is, of course, relating back to the ClimateGate emails, as they're better known. And that is something that people who follow the Corbett Report should know from our previous conversations and one of our previous videos that was one of the first videos out on the ClimateGate scandal that so far has accrued over 135,000 views. So I'll put the link to that in this as well for people to get the background. But just to make sure everyone is on the same page and up to speed with what this is all about, perhaps we should go back and set the table a little bit by talking about that original ClimateGate and ClimateGate 2.0, which ensued 2 years later, and talk about what happened there and how that developed.
Yes, well, one of the things problematic for me was that I while I was doing my doctoral thesis back in the 1980s, I had the pleasure the privilege of getting help from Professor Hubert Lamb, who founded the Climatic Research Unit in East Anglia. He set it up because he found that climate in his searches in the British Weather Office files that climate had changed dramatically over the centuries, and he believe that until we got an accurate measure of how much climate changed naturally, we were never going to be able to determine whether humans were having an impact or not. But what happened at the Climatic Research Unit, and Lamb talks about this in his autobiography, that the volume of data became very large, and of course computers were becoming available on a large scale at that time, and he hired a Professor Tom Wigley to come in and to help him. Wigley came in with a completely different view of things. Wigley was interested in the human impact and virtually nothing else, and was set about proving that humans were the cause of warming and climate change and other things. And in his autobiography, Lamb is very distressed about what went on. We still have inadequate data, but Wigley took over the Climatic Research Unit, and of course it became the center for a group of people who effectively controlled the climate science of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Wigley, through his connections with the United Kingdom Met Office and other agencies, got very large funding and people that have been very involved and exposed in the ClimateGate thing, like Benjamin Sander was a graduate student of his, Phil Jones, who's the current director, and was the director when a whole bunch of emails were leaked to the world about what was going on there. And there obviously somebody had growing concern about what was going on between the false science that they were creating. And I knew what was going on was wrong, but of course was marginalized as being a global warming skeptic and a climate change denier and paid by the oil companies. And one of the ways that I kept going was because somebody once said to me, you know, the wartime pilots knew that when the flak was very heavy, you knew you were over the target. And of course, the attacks on me just simply fueled my determination to find out what was going on. But in the meantime, they had set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and produced reports such as the infamous hockey stick, where they literally rewrote history to try and show that the current temperatures are warmer than they've ever been before, and certainly warmer than the medieval warm period. Well, somebody's looking at all this stuff, and like myself, knew there was something wrong with it, but obviously had greater insight. Now, on the other side, that's what was going on with the science within the Climatic Research Unit and the IPCC. On the other side of the two-pronged attack by Maurice Strong, who was running the United Nations Environment Program. In fact, he set it up, and he organized the Rio Conference 1992, out of which came Agenda 21, and out of which came the establishment of the IPCC through the World Meteorological Organization. These two prongs are developing side by side. So Strong set it up so he had political control through the UNEP and Agenda 21, and he had scientific control through the IPCC. The objective was, of course, to demonize CO2, and the idea was based around a comment that Strong made in a book called The Cloak of Green to Elaine Dewar back in the 1990s, where he said, you know, the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? And of course, as I've been pointing out to people for years, how do you do that? And the answer is that you show that the burning of the fossil fuels is destroying the world in some way. In this case, the CO2 was causing massive and irreversible climate warming and climate change. And it had to be a global issue in order to get all of the world's governments involved and get the whole world's attention. And, of course, it came in very nicely when the new paradigm shift to the very necessary idea of environmentalism was developing. But somebody, and so the political side was being advanced by what were called Conference of the Parties. Now, these started, the first one for climate was in Berlin, COP1, and then they occurred every year someplace around the world, and of course, they never think about the fact that when they're flying around the world, they're putting out the CO2 they're supposedly demonizing, but that's another part of the hypocrisy. But one of the COPs was, of course, that brought in the Kyoto Protocol, which was designed to punish those countries that were producing the CO2 and take that money in a great socializing effort to distribute it to the poor countries that were supposedly suffering from global warming and climate change by these rich industrialized nations. And so the COP was moving along. Kyoto was struggling. It struggled from the very start. And in fact, if Russia hadn't signed on, it would not have come into effect. Russia was going to vote against it. Putin's economic advisor, Ilarionov, is going around the world giving lectures on how what was wrong with the science. And then all of a sudden, Putin announced he was signing on to Kyoto, and Ilarionov resigned. And Putin came out and said why he was signing on, and the answer was blackmail. The European nations basically said to him, if you don't sign Kyoto, we will not support your application to join the World Trade Organization. And Putin obviously decided that was more valuable to him than any signing for Kyoto. And of course, many countries with Kyoto paid lip service. Japan, for example, ratified, but they didn't implement. And that got them off the hook. Other countries that just simply refused to ratify were demonized, like the U.S. But Kyoto was dying. And so the challenge was to keep it going. And so they had set up for Copenhagen in 2009, the COP15 was planned. And at that COP15, they were going to completely revitalize Kyoto, correct or amend those things that the countries that were opposing it found distasteful. For example, a lot of the developing nations were saying, no, you've got to set targets on everybody. For example, China had no targets. In fact, China was going to get money from those so-called developed nations, yet China in that interim years had become a massive industrial and wealthy nation and producing very large amounts of CO2. So COP15 at Copenhagen was absolutely critical to moving forward with shutting down industrialized nations, or certainly seriously limiting their power. And so it was critical for whoever leaked the emails from the CRU. They knew that. They had to get them out before COP15. And one of the reasons they also must have known this as well, and that is that the COP, the Conference for Parties, act solely on the reports and results of the IPCC. That's their authority for their political actions. And so if you could show that what the IPCC was doing was corrupted and false science, then you could bring down the whole Kyoto Protocol push for the phony or incorrectly named carbon taxes and all of the other restrictions on development and so on that the UNEP and Agenda 21 envisioned. So just prior to COP15, 1,000 emails were leaked, and it was a very interesting selection, because we now know, and in fact we knew a year later, that there were in fact 227,000 emails leaked. That's an enormous number of emails, but the initial leak was only 1,000, and the initial 1,000 were obviously very carefully selected. Whoever did this knew exactly what to do and how to do it. Now, if you came out and leaked most of the emails, people would read them and say, well, there's nothing wrong with that. These are just scientists talking about science. And unless you understood the climate science, many of them that are actually very damaging seem innocuous. And, you know, it's sort of like overhearing a mafia conversation. Unless you know you're listening to the mafia and you know the code words, it can be very innocuous conversations. So the first 1,000 emails listed not necessarily the science things that they were jiggling, but they listed things that, you know, like getting editors fired and just basically malfeasance, things that the ordinary public could look at and say, hey, that's not acceptable behavior. That there's something wrong here. If these people are behaving like this, with regard to the way they're operating, then there must be something wrong with their science. And so the 1,000 emails were very, very directed, carefully selected, and of course had their effect, because the minute they came out, they were around the world in a flash. And people, you know, especially the skeptics on websites like What's Up With That, were saying, hey, look at what's going on. I wasn't surprised at all. I knew what was going on because, as I say, I'd been at CRU from the time that Lamb was still running it. And by the way, it was embarrassing to me to hear how they were talking about Professor Lamb, the people that were working at CRU. I mean, they almost derisively, the old man and the professor, and he comes in every day, and we, you know, he just sits off in the corner, and it's really quite embarrassing. But anyway, that's another side of the story. So the 1,000 emails came out and just hit the world, and just brought basically the Copenhagen Conference, which they planned to be the great turning point with regard to Kyoto, was an absolute bust. The person who'd leaked them achieved their purpose. Now, of course, there was immediate fight back because Phil Jones, who was the director of the CRU at the time, the minute that he discovered that these emails had been leaked, he called in the police, and they announced, and he announced that these files had been stolen. And that's a critical part of the story, because as I understand, in England, if files or information is obtained illegally by hacking or stealing, then it cannot be used in court. But if the information is provided by a whistleblower, it is eligible for use in court. So for Jones to establish that these files were stolen and hacked was very critical. Now, ironically, in doing this, he had to make a very, very important statement, and that was he had to say, yes, these files are genuine. So they couldn't use the, oh, well, these are made up, these are somebody playing games. He had to admit that they were his in order to designate them as stolen. So he tied his hands that way. Now, the interesting thing is, the second thing he did after calling in the police was to get a public relations person. And they involved the University of East Anglia in their offensive, and actually it was a defense in the form of an offense. They hired a public relations guy, as I recall, the name was Neil Wallace. And he'd been involved, and in fact, later on, he went to jail because he was involved in the phone hacking scandals of the News of the World. So, of course, the question I always ask is, why do these people need public relations? And the answer is because what they're doing is political, not scientific. But the 1,000 emails then had that effect. But the counterattack, saying that these were stolen, that this is illegal, and that what we're doing, and Jones made the comment, oh, no, this is just normal banter between colleagues. Well, that anybody reads those files, this is not normal banter. It may be normal banter between, you know, people doing illegal things, but nothing else. But a year later, the next COP 16, was planned for Durban, in 2009, in the fall of 2009, and at Durban, 2010? They hoped. Well, oh, sorry, 2000. Thank you, James. Thank you. Yes, they hoped to recover what they had lost at Copenhagen, and so that became a big focus. And it appeared over the course of the year that they had papered over, and I use the term paper because the mainstream media, particularly the left-wing mainstream media, were very, very active in the cover-up, particularly the New York Times and George Monbiot at The Guardian. Now, Monbiot, I'll give him his credit, he did say he was shocked by the emails. They didn't do anything to really listen to what was going on and look at what was going on. Revkin resigned because, of course, he's named in the emails, and as is Borenstein, another New York Times correspondent. And these people in the emails, you know, they're emailing to the CRU people saying, look, this has been said. What do you got to say about this? How do we deal with this? Tell us what to say. In other words, they were acting as shills for these people. And it appeared that the first leak, although it did stop the Copenhagen or slowed it down, it didn't appear to divert it sufficiently. So another leak occurred in 2010 prior to Durban, and this time it was 5,000 emails, and they were much, much broader in what they covered. They provided more detail about the interaction between these people, the way they attacked individuals who had been questioning their work, how they had controlled the peer review process, and how they had arranged who would be the authors on different articles, and on and on and on, but by the time that 5,000 were leaked, it was really no longer a news story, and not just because of the dominance of the stories by the mainstream media and the ignoring of it, the real significance of it, but because the world has said, or most of the people have said, yeah, okay. They said what I hear so often after I've given a presentation. I had my suspicions, but I didn't know enough to know. Well, now they didn't understand, but they knew enough to know that, hey, there's something going on here. Now, that was assisted by Mother Nature, because Mother Nature was giving very cold winters and snow. And cartoons started appearing about, you know, the snow is due to global warming and the cold is due to warming and the complete illogic. And then that added to that illogic was, and it's interesting how certain statements by people resonate far more than they ever had the intention of it. When Al Gore appeared before the U.S. Senate and said, the science is settled. The debate is over. The science is settled. Well, of course, there never was a debate, and the science is never settled. And even some of the mainstream media knew that that was a completely false statement. And so all of these things, the cold weather, Gore's outrageous statement, and all of these things came together to really essentially derail the whole process. Well, it didn't derail it in the context that governments saw an opportunity for more taxation. The only thing that any government does efficiently is find new ways to tax people. It's sort of like with business. The only department in any business, or most businesses, that works efficiently is in debt collection. I tease a lot of businesses, say, look, you should take your debt collection group and put them over in customer service, and hopefully things will work better. But governments, of course, had politicians had bought into this. They put on what I call the cloak of green. I'm a global warming's a problem, climate change is a problem, and we've got to stop it. But actually, underneath, they weren't doing very much. But they did see the potential for taxes. I think that what you're going to see in the near future, and probably as part of the deal with approving the Keystone Pipeline, is Obama's going to say, okay, I'll approve the pipeline, but we're going to have to bring in a carbon tax to offset the potential damage. And so that political use of the bad science has gone on. Even industry is still exploiting it. People selling cars because they have less carbon output. And of course, they don't mean carbon, they mean CO2. But that's another measure of how wrong this whole story is. And so what happened, ironically, a couple of weeks after I published that article on what's up with that, the leaker, who is now known as Mr. FOIA, which is, of course, is the acronym for Freedom of Information Act, released the remaining 227,000 emails, and people are now frantically going through them, looking for more evidence of malfeasance and corruption and deliberate diverting of the truth. And we will see over the next several months, more and more information will leak out. Now, in my article, I identified speculatively that it had to be an insider that released these emails. And I got attacked for that. I don't know why. It was a perfectly reasonable speculation based upon evidence, and I presented the evidence for it. But there were also a lot of people agreed with me. But there are still a lot that don't. Now, one of the groups that don't believe it was an inside job were the police, because the police that Jones called in originally which was the local Norfolk police in Norwich. They called in a special police unit from Scotland Yard to investigate the leaks. They dragged on until the statute of limitations on any possible legal action from their findings had passed. And they came out, and the report or a synopsis of the report runs to a couple of pages, but they're basically saying, no, it wasn't an inside job. They say it came out through a Russian internet provider. Well, everybody knew that. And, they say there was no evidence within the computer system at East Anglia. And by the way, the person had to know not only how to get into the climatic research unit computers, but they had to get to them through the University of East Anglia computer. So they had to know the inside system. Yeah, there are hackers. They can get into some pretty, pretty sophisticated file systems, but it took more than that. And one of the things that this latest release of 227,000 emails indicates is that it was an inside job, because the person who released them said he didn't have time to go through them all. So he's throwing them out there and letting the people parse them up and share the workload. But what I don't understand is, if he didn't go through them, how did he know which of the first 1,000 to pick and put out? Because they were clearly very carefully selected. It had to be somebody that knew from the inside. Otherwise, he would have gone through the whole 227,000, yet he's telling us that he didn't.
Well, so let's bring in some of the actual writing that he wrote on this. So for people who are interested, I'll include a link to a bishophill.squarespace.com link to the ClimateGate 3.0 message from FOIA himself. And they can read through what he actually wrote there. For example, along those lines, he wrote that, quote, "I prepared ClimateGate 1 and 2 alone. Even skimming through all 220,000 emails would have taken several more months of work in an increasingly unfavorable environment." In an increasingly unfavorable environment. Dumping them all into the public domain would be the last resort. Majority of the emails are irrelevant, some of them probably sensitive and socially damaging. And so he's releasing all 220,000 now. That does to me seem to, the preponderance of that language seems to me to indicate that that was coming from the inside and someone who was at least familiar enough to be able to identify the most scientifically relevant, if not all of them, or at least that's the implication of what he's saying there. So I think you're exactly right in that speculation. It doesn't seem like you're going out on a limb with that from that language.
Well, that's the part that has bothered me. And as I said, I don't understand why certain people want to deny. I mean, the police, I can understand. For my opinion, the police were brought in as part of the cover-up, and the fact that they delayed the studies until the statute of limitations had expired on it, and the fact that they would presumably have more information than we have, and yet they conclude it wasn't an inside job. But as I said, based on what we've got, it just screams at you. And as you say, reading what the person themselves say, there really is very limited ways of interpreting that. And it is one of those things where you've got to know the climate science. You've got to know the computer models. You've got to know what was going on politically with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, with the relationship between the Climatic Research Unit and the United Kingdom Met Office. And you have to know the personalities of the people involved. Because you notice the comment that he makes, that there are some emails that are socially damaging. Well, what is he talking about? He's talking about people that are doing things that are illegal, and that if it comes out, their careers are over.
Well, that's exactly right. And let me just back up what you're saying, because certainly if that 220,000 email treasure trove dropped into my lap, even having a certain basic layman understanding of the general ideas, there's no way that I would have been able to parse through that to pick out even 1,000 of the most relevant or interesting emails. There's no way I would have had the ability to even begin such an enterprise by myself. I think it necessarily means that the person who did that does have knowledge of the subject matter.
Well, and obviously also they were developing a conscience over a long period of time about what was going on. I mean, you could argue that, oh, well, yeah, okay, I'm going to hack in and, oh, look what I found. That could happen. But when you read the commentary that precedes the release of the other two sets of emails and the commentary in the third one, where it's somebody with a conscience, period, but more important, a social and political awareness of the damage of what these people have done is doing to the world in terms of forcing carbon taxes on pushing biofuels, which are, you know, causing grain prices to go up, so people are starving, and the commentary is very heavily a social concern about the implications of what these people are doing, and as you read through it, it to me, it's somebody who has been thinking about this and growing increasingly uncomfortable with the knowledge that they had, and of course, then that's reinforced by the fact that when you read the emails, the rest of the people are all intent on, as the phrase that comes up, what we're doing is necessary for the cause. Well, what's the cause you're talking about? And nobody's really investigated that. I mean, yeah, there's been a couple of articles written about it and the reference to it, but the cause in it gives the implication that there's a particular agenda going on here. And obviously the person who leaked, Mr. FOIA, became increasingly concerned about the corruption of that agenda, and realized that at a certain point that the end doesn't justify the means.
Well, and again, let's back this up with some of his own words, where, for example, he writes that the first glimpses I got behind the scenes did little to garner my trust in the state of climate science. On the contrary, I found myself in front of a choice that just might have a global impact. Briefly put, when I had to balance the interests of my own safety, privacy, career of a few scientists, and the well-being of billions of people living in the coming several decades, the first two weren't the decisive concern. So again, this is absolutely explicit in his email that he was explicitly considering the impact of what the general ramifications of this philosophy, this cause that is guiding these scientists is, and that's exactly what the motivation behind this release was in the first place.
Well, exactly. And so it isn't as if he just stumbled on this. This is something he's clearly been observing and growing increasingly concerned about, and of course, then when the pressure came, now there was a story that, and I got attacked viciously for saying this, but there was a story out, and it's still available. People can Google it. Not all of the 1,000 emails, but some of them were leaked to a Paul Hudson. Now, Paul Hudson had been with the UK Met Office as a meteorologist and then got hired by the BBC. And Hudson had written an article for the BBC publication saying, look, there's something wrong with the science here. The CO2 issue is not working out. And in the leaked emails, of course, Hudson, they're attacking him. There's emails going back and forth saying, have you seen what this BBC guy has written? And then one of the persons in the leaked emails at the CRU says, look, our contact person at the BBC is Richard Black. And I'll find out from him what's going on and get him to deal with it. And Hudson, according to the original stories, sat on the emails for 5 weeks and did nothing. And I suspect that he did nothing because Hudson had already received the wrath of the people at CRU. He knew what happened if you stepped out of line, and of course he didn't want to lose his job. And so I suspect that he didn't do anything about it. I also suspect that the person that did the original or did the leaking was getting increasingly frustrated for time because Copenhagen was fast approaching. Hudson got these emails in October, and Copenhagen was scheduled for, I think it was November, late November. And so I think what happened was that Hudson did nothing about it. So the person said, that's it. I'm going to go out through a Russian internet provider. Now, the police report said, oh, well, there was no evidence that it came out from within the university through the university computer system. Well, of course not. And all the people that worked at CRU would have had access to the files from outside because they were traveling around the world attending these conferences, and they would have needed to have access to their files back at the CRU. There's a lot of businesses and places have that option. So it didn't necessarily have to be done from within the university system. And so the Hudson story is an interesting part of this. And I was told, oh no, it Hudson never got them. He was mistaken. I don't think he was mistaken at all. I think that that, as I said, the person said, who better than a meteorologist at the BBC who'd already shown signs that he was troubled with the science. And I'll leak it out through him, and the BBC, of course, with the worldwide service that they have, would get it global in a flash. Well, as I said, that didn't happen. And then all of a sudden, the stuff comes out through this Russian internet provider. And I do buy the story that the Russian internet provider was used because they're essentially untraceable. As I said, there's some interesting aspects of this that have just got brushed aside. But when you start piecing it all together, the finger points at an inside job. And as I said, somebody who knew. Now, I happen to suggest that it's Keith Briffa, because Briffa was on the outside within the group. There were constant battles. He was constantly battling with Michael Mann and others, and over the hockey stick and the use of the tree rings and so on. And then in the middle of the battles, Briffa got his mother got ill. He took time off, and then he got ill. So he was absent for a few months in that critical time period, and nobody knew better what was going on inside of the CRU than Briffa. But that was my speculation. Certainly when you look at his pattern and the emails by him and about him, I think he's a very strong candidate. But as I said, that's simply my speculation based on as much of the evidence as I can gather.
Well, it is speculation, but again, it's important for the listeners to understand that this issue is not a side issue in the ClimateGate affair. In fact, it goes to the very heart of the possibility for prosecution in this type of affair, because let's reiterate that in the UK, it is absolutely inadmissible if this information has been hacked illegally for it to be used in a prosecution in court, whereas if it has been leaked from the inside, then it is permissible to be used for such a prosecution. So that's why this is a debate that also has legal ramifications, although perhaps not anymore now that the official police inquiry has elapsed. The statute of limitations has come and gone, and the investigation has been, I believe, officially closed.
Well, of course, the larger issue is the police should be investigated. What were all the emails, and how did it so quickly and easily get shuffled aside? What were the role of these PR people who had, and by the way, the guy Wallace, he was working in the Prime Minister's office, Cameron's office. He was connected to that high, And of course, when you start saying, well, you know, what were the police doing? How did they let the thing slide? They had to know about the statute of limitations. If they didn't, they're totally incompetent. And of course, then we come up against Cicero's famous quote, "Who polices the police?" And so there's for me, there's that ramification, and there's still the wider ramification of how Morris Strong was able to take over the United Nations and set up this whole structure to literally deceive the world. I've got a book coming out in a month or so, I hope, because I think this is the greatest deception in history, that a few people were able to, and that, by the way, is part of the difficulty, because you get sidelined. Timbaugh, he's a conspiracy theorist. Well, that's become a way of putting you down, that you're some kind of a nut. But I've never called it a conspiracy. It's the group is known as a cabal, and a cabal is a small group of people with a political agenda, and these have gone on throughout history. And Morris Strong, hit the pattern of how he set it up, as I talked about earlier, where he controlled the political side through Agenda 21 and the UN, and he controlled the scientific side through the UN and the IPCC. And by the way, one of the things that he very cleverly did, because he's an absolute master. I've talked to people that grew up with him, went to school with him, have worked with him, worked for him. And they all say that he is extremely persuasive, and he is a superb bureaucratic organizer. And he set up the IPCC through the World Meteorological Organization. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, the World Meteorological Organization is a UN agency with virtually every country's weather office is a member. And, of course, that gave him control then of the climate science that was the official science in every country in the world. And just as an illustration, Environment Canada, an assistant deputy minister of Environment Canada, chaired the founding meeting of the IPCC at Villach, Austria in 1985. And if you read what Richard Lindzen's written about how, you know, most of the IPCC are simply bureaucrats. They're not climate scientists. They're not scientists at all. They're bureaucrats. And, of course, that's exactly what Morris Strong wanted. And, of course, if your National Weather Agency is taking a scientific position and saying, oh, CO2's the problem, we've got to stop it, global warming, climate change, you got to do this, that, the other. And then the politicians say, hey, hang on a minute. These people, can they say, hey, we're the experts. We're your official scientific advisors on climate. How dare you question us? So it gave them direct control of climate science in every country in the world. And not only that, it gave them control of the funding of climate research in every country in the world. Because in Canada, for example, in order to keep politics out of research, the Canadian government had set up agencies, one for science, one for social sciences and humanities, and one for medicine. And these agencies are given money by the government, but then the government have no say in how those agencies distribute that money. Now, obviously, there's politics in everything, but it is at least one step removed from direct political control. But the only research funding that was coming from government directly, from a government bureaucracy directly to the researcher, was climate research going through Environment Canada. And the Auditor General of Canada in 2007 produced a report showing that in a seven-year stretch, they spent $6.8 billion on climate change. And all of it went to people that were proving the hypothesis that CO2 is causing warming, when in fact the proper scientific method requires that you disprove it, mm-hmm. that it's what Popper calls falsifiability.
Exactly right.
So,
yeah.
Right. So by controlling the bureaucracies of every national weather agency, Strong gave direct control. And of course, every government says, oh, well, you know, it's the IPCC, and we're getting that from our bureaucrats. And to give you an idea of the level of control, and this person has input into a previous attempt to show that human actions were destroying the planet, and that's the CFC ozone issue. There never, ever was any evidence that CFCs were destroying ozone in the ozone layer. But the person who claimed that they had evidence was a Susan Solomon. And Susan Solomon worked for NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, the National Weather Agency in the U.S. And Susan Solomon went on to become the co-chair of the IPCC reports. And so the involvement of these bureaucrats in establishing policy and controlling the science that establishes the policy is so incestuous that it's amazing that that they've been able to get away with it. And a part of it is, of course, because, say, the politicians don't understand the science, that the few of us that know what's going on, they've been able to marginalize us very easily. You know, I've had lawsuits, and I've got lawsuits, and I'm called a global warming skeptic. But there's a phrase right there that gives you an idea of what's gone on and how it's gone on. All scientists are skeptics. I wasn't skeptic that global warming was occurring. I was a skeptic about the cause. But, of course, the public didn't know that. And for the public, the word skeptic is somebody who is just negative about everything, not to be listened to. But that's all scientists must be skeptical. If you're not skeptical, you're not a scientist. But it's this clever use of these terms, many of them, by the way, created by PR companies.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. Well, unfortunately, it is getting quite late here in Japan, so I think we'll have to start wrapping this conversation up. But before we do, I wanted to touch on one other aspect of the ClimateGate 3.0 leak, which is the fact that we have been talking about these emails and as being released. But in fact, what happened was that FOIA sent the password to the 220,000 email file to a select few bloggers in the climate science community. And that has generated some controversy in and of itself. Why not release them all to the public? Of course, as the FOIA made clear, he's considering some of these social ramifications of these emails, etc., and hoping that they can be parsed through. Perhaps you can comment on that aspect of things, and also what types of emails have so far filtered through to the community at large.
Well, I think that he's showing his conscience. I mean, he's saying, look, there's stuff in here that could be socially and damaging to individuals. And that's not his intent. His intent is that the public and people see the scientific damage that these people have done. Now, there are social ramifications for that, and that's what he's concerned about. But the fact that he has a conscience about the damage to, almost collateral damage to innocent bystanders, people that were doing things that they'd be embarrassed to others to know about, but weren't necessarily illegal. He's making judgment calls, and I think that's very respectable. The people that he's chosen to release them to are people that are pretty well aware of what's gone on, the ClimateGate thing, and they are the skeptics. They are the lead skeptics. And so what he's done is he's chosen people that he knows will be able to go through those 227,000 emails and pull out what is scientifically damaging, but would not use anything that would hurt individuals. And the way that he's done that gives me even more respect for this individual, because it shows to me his awareness and sensitivity about individuals as opposed to groups, Science as opposed to the social implications and ramifications of it. So to me, this is just further evidence of why the person did what they did in the first place.
Excellent. Well, again, I will direct people to the Bishop Hill blog, which has the post from FOIA himself, and of course also to your article, which, well, you say rather self-effacedly that ironically it was released a couple of weeks after your article. I think it was more than irony. I believe there was probably some actual causal connection there, but of course, again, that's just speculation on my own part. But at any rate, we'll put the link back to your article, which preceded the release of these emails by 2 weeks. It's time for the person who leaked the CRU emails to step forward. And we will also put in a few notes to some of the updates and emails that have so far come out and been parsed by some of these bloggers. So a very interesting development. We'll obviously have to keep our eye on it, and I will be keeping my eye on drtimball.com for all of the latest updates, and I hope people will go there for more information on that. I think we'll leave things there for today, but once again, always a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Ball.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, James, and thanks for the work that you're doing.